You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Wonderful to be with you live from our studios here in Johannesburg. And we are talking about adventures in Jewish history. We've been going through our crash course in Jewish history. We did take a little bit of a break, but now we're coming back to our crash course in Jewish history. And I'm very excited to do so. So important for us to have at least a basic overview of the history of the Jewish people, of the story of the Jewish people. And that speaks for itself and gives one so much clarity and understanding as to the Jewish world today and as to the journey and the destiny of our people, of the Jewish people. We finished off talking, if I remember correctly, last time, about the end of the existence of Jews in Spain, of the sojourn of the Jewish community in Spain with the Spanish Inquisition in 1492. We discussed that there were 300 years, over 300, 350 years of the, they were known as the golden years of Spanish Jewry, in which the Jews at first were welcomed and were protected by the state and were able to thrive both materially and spiritually. And it was a wonderful, period in the history of the Jewish people, those 350 years of the golden age of Spain. And then, unfortunately, things began to turn bad, and ultimately the Jews were expelled from Spain with a decree by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, and in Tisha B'Av 1492, they were given the fate of either leaving Spain or converting to Christianity, otherwise they would face the sword. And so half of the Jewish community of Spain ended up leaving, the other half ended up converting to Christianity. Many of them still practice Judaism in secret, in hiding. Those are the Moranos, the Conversos. And that's what the Inquisition was about. The Inquisition was trying to weed out Jews that were supposed to have converted to Christianity, but were still practicing in hiding as Jews. So the Inquisition was to inquire whether they were, these Jews had become sincere Christians or they were still Jews in secret. And many Jews suffered also at the hands of the Inquisition. Many thousands of Jews were tortured and were burned at the stake. And in the Middle Ages, a confession under torture was regarded as legitimate. So the Jews were tortured until they confessed, and then they were executed. So it wasn't pretty at all, and a tragic end to the Jewish community in Spain. So those are the Sephardim. What happened with those Jews that left Spain, the half of the Spanish Jews that left? They went all over the Mediterranean basin. They settled in Greece. That's how Jews got to Greece, in Salonika, in the Balkans, in the Near East, in Morocco, in other countries in North Africa. And some of them, a small number, went back to Eretz Israel, went to the land of Israel. Let's now look at the Ashkenazim. What's happening with the Ashkenazim? So remember, let's take a bit of a step back and summarize, from a broader perspective, how did the Jews get to Spain in the first place? Well, the Jews, after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Byzantine Christians took over the land of Israel, and they made it impossible for Jews to remain in the land of Israel as practicing Jews. Either you had to convert or you had to leave. And so most of the Jews went to Babel, to Babylonia, where there was already a strong established community. And the center of the Jewish world was in Babylonia for about 1,000 years, with the great centers of learning and with the very strong infrastructure of the Jewish community in Babel. It's there that the Talmud is written, the Babylonian Talmud, Talmud Bavli, between the years 300 and 600 of the Common Era, is the writing of the Babylonian Talmud. And the development of the great learning academies in the centers of the Jewish community in Babylonia. From the year approximately 900 of the Common Era, there was quite a significant amount of movement of the Jewish community. Many Jews had left Babylonia, which is today's Iran and Iraq, and they had settled in North Africa on the Mediterranean basin, and many were going across the straits into the Iberian Peninsula, into Spain. It was a place that had opened up with great opportunity, and many Muslims went into Spain, and Jews joined them. And together they built up Spain, and they coexisted in peace and harmony, and and built a productive and successful society. And that's how the Jews ended up in Spain, going to Morocco, North Africa, and across the Mediterranean into Spain. At that same time, there were also Jews that left Babylonia to go into Western Europe. The Jews were invited by the noblemen, by the monarchy in both Germany and France, to settle in Western Europe. And although the numbers were much smaller, in terms of the amount of Jews that left Babylon and went to Western Europe, as opposed to the amount of Jews that went to Spain. But nonetheless, that was the beginning of the Ashkenazi Jewish community and the Ashkenazi world. So you have the great center in Babylonia, many going into Spain, the beginning of the Sephardim. Sephard is Spain in Hebrew. And some much smaller numbers going into Western Europe, into France, and into Germany. And that's the beginning of the Ashkenazi. In fact, that's why the Ashkenazi world has issues with many different genetic problems, more than other portions of the population, because all Ashkenazi Jews actually came from quite a small gene pool, from a small number of people, which were the beginnings of the Jewish inhabitants in Europe, in Western Europe. So we've now discussed the Sephardim and unfortunately the end of Jews for Spain and how they then spread into many other countries. After this ad break, we will discuss what happened with the Ashkenazim at that time as well.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So the Jews that were first in Western Europe, that small group that were the beginnings, the roots of Ashkenazi Jewry, they too were invited, as I mentioned, and they successfully integrated into the communities and were productive parts of society. However, there was a major shift. We see the pattern, which we'll be repeating today as well, is that usually in many places that Jews found themselves in the exile, they were often invited to those places and they were often welcomed into those places, and they were able to successfully be there for two or three centuries. And after two or three centuries, that's when things went bad for the Jews and they experienced difficulty in those places. And that seems to be a pattern in Jewish history, with almost without exception throughout the exile, our long and painful exile of the last 2,000 years. And so likewise, it was the case in Western Europe, where the Jews arrived and were welcomed and were invited to be there, and they integrated and developed both spiritually and materially in communities in France and in Germany. And then there was a catastrophic event that swept across Europe, and that was the bubonic plague. The bubonic plague was between the years 1347 and 1351. The estimated numbers of fatalities from the bubonic plague, the Black Death as it was known, is between 100 and 200 million people. One third of European population was wiped out by the Black Death. And nobody really knew what it was and what was happening. But they did notice that the Jewish community was dying less than the rest of the population. And today we know why that is, because as part of our practice of living as Jews and following halacha, so we wash our hands regularly. We wash our hands when we wake up in the morning. We wash our hands after we go to the bathroom. We wash our hands before we eat bread. We're not allowed to daven unless we clean after going to the bathroom. So automatically the levels of hygiene within the Jewish communities was much better than in the non-Jewish communities in those areas, and therefore the plague spread far less amongst the Jews as opposed to the non-Jews. As a result, the people blamed the Jews. They said, you're not dying the same rate as we are. Obviously, this is a Jewish conspiracy, and you're contaminating the wells, and you are trying to wipe out our communities. And as a result of that, there was a massive wave of pogroms that swept across Germany. And the Jews were in Germany. They were in Bohemia, which is in Prague, and at east in. So the Jews were then forced to leave. So they were in Western Europe in those areas for about 200 or 300 years. And then with these pogroms that were initiated by the bubonic plague, many Jews got up and left and moved further east into Europe. They moved into Poland, Lithuania and Russia. And again, the Jews were invited by the kings and by the noblemen to help develop the country. And the first, again, the first, so in Western Europe, we see in Spain that was the case, 350 years and then it went bad. Western Europe, 350 years and then we had to flee because of the pogroms. And now Eastern Europe, the Jews again are invited by the kings and the noblemen, again they're protected, by the authorities and they built strong communities. But the pattern repeated itself, unfortunately, lasted 200-300 years, and then, you know, we saw the end of the Jewish communities in this case, it's 600 years, unfortunately. But we'll see, it began after 300 years, it started turning bad for the Jews in Eastern Europe as well. The Jews at first felt very safe in Poland. They called Poland, in Hebrew, the word Poland is Polin, and they said it stands for the words Polin. Over here we will rest. Lin is to sleep, to rest in the exile. The Jews built strong communities in Krakow, in Dublin, in Vilna. The Jews also developed strong communities in the Baltic cities, in Memel, in Hamburg, in Helsinki. The Jews supplied the ships and the merchants in the Hanseatic League, which was an independent organization of merchants, and it was very powerful and wealthy at the time. So we see the Sephardi Jews experience very great difficulty in the 15th century, and likewise a little bit earlier in the 14th century, the Ashkenazi Jewry also experienced prejudice and anti-Semitism, and also had to move, and they therefore moved further east. And most of us here in South Africa are descendants of Lithuanian Jews, so that's how our ancestors ended up in Lithuania. First they were in Germany and in France, and then they moved further east to escape the pogroms, and that's how the communities and large numbers of Jews ended up in Eastern Europe. When the Jewish community, there's a trend within the Jewish people that often when we experience hardship and suffering, there's often a turn to spiritual ideas and spiritual explanations for the difficulties that we're going through, the disasters and the suffering that we're experiencing. And we see, therefore, at a similar time, when both the Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jews are uprooted from where they are and having to scatter and disperse further, so there was a big turn to Kabbalistic teachings and writings and understanding and messianic aspirations. We see at in the 16th century, in the 1540s, there was a very great Jew by the name of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. He's known as the Ramak. He was born in 1522 and he died in 1570. And he developed the school of Kabbalists in Sfat. So that's how the great Kabbalists were through many generations or come from Sfat. The beginning of that movement was by Rav Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, in the 1540s. And he attracted the greatest Kabbalistic scholars of the time, and they came to learn by him in his school of Kabbalah in Sfat in the middle of the 16th century. A certain Jew joined him at that time. His name was Rav Yitzhak Luria. He's known as the Arizal, the Ari, Zichron Levrocha. And he is also known as Rav Yitzhak Ashkenazi, because his mother was Sephardi and his father was Ashkenazi. He was born in Jerusalem. His father, the Ari's father, was died when he was young, and he moved together with his mother to Egypt, where his mother's brother, his uncle, lived, and his uncle was a very wealthy merchant. And his uncle saw in his nephew a real prodigy. He was a genius. He was a very holy child, a very holy person. And his uncle supported him in learning, and he dedicated himself 24/7 to the study of Torah and to developing himself as a holy, pious Jew. He knew Kol HaTorah Kulo. He knew both Nigla and Nista, both the revealed parts of the Torah and the hidden parts of the Torah, at a very young age. And when he heard about the school of Kabbalists in Tzfat, he was attracted to join them. And he went to Tzfat and arrived just a year before the Ramak passed away. The Ramak was Nifta in 1570. And the Arizal then took over that school of Kabbalah as a very young man. And he carried on that school of Kabbalah. And he introduced a brand of Kabbalah which swept across the Jewish world. He was the only one who was really able to unlock the keys of the Zohar. The Zohar was written 2,000 years ago by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the great Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shimon's buried in Miron, and many go there on Lag BaOmer on his Yotzat. Many thousands of Jews make a pilgrimage to Miron on the Yotzat of Shimon bar Yochai. So he was the one who wrote the Zohar, which is the classic work of Jewish mysticism. Was the Arizal 1,500 years later, who was the one who actually explained what the Zohar is saying and what Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai meant. And the teachings of the Arizal were disseminated amongst through his students. Primarily, his main Talmud was Reb Chaim Vital. And he wrote the Derech Etz Chaim and explained the teachings and the understanding, the Kabbalistic system of the Arizal. The Arizal only was 3 years in Sfat, and he taught, he revealed all of these many secrets of Kabbalistic wisdom in those short 3 years. He died at the tender age of 39 years old and achieved so much in those years. At that time also, there was another great Jew that joined that group of holy people. His name was Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo was born in 1488 in Toledo in Spain. And as a child, he was exiled from Spain. He was 4 years old when his family was forced to leave because of the Inquisition. And he lived in Turkey. He lived in Greece. And he arrived in Sfat in 1535, which was 5 years before the 5 years before of the Ramak, Rav Moshe Karavero, and he was with Rav Moshe Karavero for a significant amount of years. He was part of that holy group in Sfat. Now, Rav Yosef Karo wrote a famous commentary on the Tur. The Tur is a great work on the Talmud, which summarizes the halachic discussions of the Talmud. And the Beis Yosef is a commentary on the Torah. So any rabbi who wants to know the build-up and background of halacha, the first place he'll look is at the Torah and then the Beis Yosef, because the Beis Yosef brings all the Gemaras that are relevant to that particular halachic discussion. He also, Rav Yosef Karo, wrote a commentary on the Rambam called the Kesef Mishnah, and that also is a very valuable work because he wrote sources for the Rambam. If you remember when we discussed the Rambam, one of the criticisms is the Rambam's Magnus Opus, the Mishnah Torah, he didn't write sources. So Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Kesef Mishnah, which are sources to the teachings of the Rambam. Now, listen to this. It's really fascinating. One of the rabbis, one of the teachers of Rav Yosef Karo was Rav Yaakov Beirav. In fact, I was just in Jerusalem and I was walking in the streets and I saw the street called Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. So I know about him because he was the Rebbe of Yosef Karo, but I was very excited to see the street. I think you could learn a lot of Jewish history just from the streets of Israel and Jerusalem in particular. Rav Yaakov Beirav, he felt that it was time to renew the Sanhedrin. So remember, we're talking about the 16th century, the 1500s. And he felt the Sanhedrin had ended in 450 of the Common Era. So we're just over 1,100 years later. And for a Sanhedrin to be constituted, it was necessary that each member receive smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu, which means Moshe Rabbeinu gave smicha, he gave ordination to his Talmid, to his student, and that student gave the ordination when he felt his student was ready. And so that's how the chain of smicha passed down through the generations. And to be a member of the Sanhedrin, you had to have received smicha in that line, from that chain that goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. That ended in the year 450 of the Common Era. And Rav Yaakov Beirav felt that it was now time to renew the Sanhedrin. The Rambam explains and says that one could restore the Sanhedrin if all the leading rabbis in the land of Israel would agree that a particular rabbi is the scholar of the generation, the leader of the generation. And if they would all accept that he's the leader of the generation, then that person who would be the unanimous leader of Klal Yisrael then has the power and ability to give smicha to his Talmud and to his students. So remember, interesting enough, the Rambam says all the rabbis of Israel, not all the rabbis not rabbis outside of Israel, but specifically the rabbis in Israel, all have to accept that this person is the leader of the generation, then that person can grant smicha to his students, to his Talmudim. Rav Yaakov Beirav has a plan to do this. He calls a convention of all the rabbis, and the rabbis that were at the convention agreed, and they wanted to appoint him as the leader of the generation, and then he would give smicha to others, including his Talmud Rav Yosef Karo, which was his Talmud. However, one of the rabbis was not part of the convention. He was the rabbi of Jerusalem. His name was Rabbi Levi Ibn Chabiv, and he was very strongly opposed to this idea on many different grounds, and he mobilized the dissenting opinions throughout the Jewish world, and so the idea was dropped. Rav Yaakov Beirav himself, even though he initiated the idea, he dropped the idea because he saw that there was opposition. And with the opposition of rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, it wouldn't be legitimate, it wouldn't be unanimous, and therefore it wouldn't work. Actually, we see, interestingly, when the State of Israel was founded, so Rav Herzog and Rav Maimon also had an idea of renewing the Sanhedrin, but there were many great rabbis at the time that were opposed to it, and so they also, even though they proposed the idea, they also dropped it and didn't carry it further. Of Yosef Karo then, he's living through all of this, he sees all of this, and he realizes that we need a substitute for the Sanhedrin, and so he decides to write his famous work, the Shulchan Aruch. Now the Shulchan Aruch was written in 1563, was really a monumental work in which Rav Yosef Karo took the majority opinion. He took the works of the Rif, of the Rosh, and of the Rambam. So we don't really have time now to explain what all of these were, but we have the Talmud. The Talmud is the discussions of the halachic discussions, and also Agadic, also it's not only halachic, the discussions are that took place in the Bate Midrashos of Babel, in the study halls of Babel, of the great sages of Babylonia, between the year 300 and 600 of the Common Era. That's what the Talmud is. It's a recording and was edited by Ravina and Rav Ashi of those discussions, which really incorporates the entire Masorah, the entire Jewish tradition. All of the oral law is included in the Talmud. And so if somebody wants to understand Torah law and understand what God wants of the Jewish people, God's Torah, so one has to learn the Talmud. There are 2,711 pages, they're double pages of the Talmud, and that's what's called Shas, Shisha Sidre Mishnah. And if a person wants to be a real and genuine holy Jew, so one has to study Talmud, understand both the unique style of the Talmud, and of course the content of the Talmud. So it's all there in the Talmud. What happened was 1,000 years after the Talmud, maybe 800 to 1,000 years after the Talmud. So in the period of the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Rosh, and the Rif, they summarized the halakhic discussions of the Talmud. In other words, the Talmud could speak many pages on a certain halakhic issue and brings questions and contradictions and answers up those contradictions and ensures that the final result is watertight and stands up to any questions or any loose ends that have not been dealt with. And so what the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh did, they each had their own version of summarizing and writing the conclusions of those discussions in the Talmud. What Rav Yosef Karo did is he took those opinions, the Rambam, Rish, and the Rosh, and he summarized their opinions into the final halacha, into the definitive halachic view, halachic action, practice of the Jewish people. So Shulchan Aruch became the central work of Jewish law, and it's accepted as the final authority of Jewish law, based on written by Rav Yosef Karo. So it was a real monumental work that was greatly needed and transformed the Jewish world. Now, nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything is b'yad Hashem, b'ashkochas Hashem, with divine providence. And as it turned out, the writing of the Shulchan Aruch in 1563 was just after the printing press became available to the wider public. The printing press was actually invented by Johann Gutenberg in Germany in the year 1439, so it was quite a lot earlier, but it only became accessible and available in the early 16th century, in the 1500s. So when the Shulchan Aruch was written, it was just at the time when the printing press became widespread. And The printing press at first, interestingly enough, was opposed by the church. The church were threatened by it and felt that many new ideas would now become accessible. Up until that point, they were able to control all the ideas that were available to the broader public, and now they wouldn't be able to control those ideas. And also, the first book printed by the printing press was the Bible. The second book was a book of pornography. And the second book way outsold the first one. And so there was concern that these kind of immoral ideas would spread widely in society. The Jewish world always embraced the printing press because the Jewish people are a scholarly people, and we want ideas and knowledge to spread as much as possible. And we want our average person to be educated and understand Torah and understand Torah law and to become a Talmud Chochem. Every Jew should be a Talmud Chochem, should be a person of who's informed and who has a knowledge and an understanding and the ability to think and analyze and come to conclusions. So the printing press took off in the Jewish world. And as a result, the Shulchan Aruch was printed on a large scale, and within 20 years, it spread across the Jewish world, and there was almost no community in Klal Yisrael that didn't have a Shulchan Aruch. We'll discuss after this break what happened when the Shulchan Aruch arrived in Eastern Europe, where the Ashkenazi Jews were.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
The Shulchan Aruch was written in 1563 and spread across the Jewish world. When it arrived in Eastern Europe, and the Ashkenazi Jews saw this classic and work of great genius, Rav Yosef Karo, so they were put into a little bit of a dilemma, because on the one hand, most of what's written in Shulchan Aruch is also practiced by the Ashkenazim, but on the other hand, there are some differences and some nuances that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't take care of with regard to the Ashkenazim, for the Ashkenazi community. And so Rav Moshe Isserles, who was really the greatest rabbi in the Ashkenazi world at the time, he was the rabbi in Krakow in Poland, he was actually working on a similar work that Rav Yosef Karo was, but Rav Yosef Karo just beat him to the finish line. So either he could have come out with his own version of the Shulchan Aruch, an Ashkenazi version of the Shulchan Aruch, but he, with great humility and great wisdom, instead chose to write notes on the Shulchan Aruch. So the Ashkenazim would use the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo, and where there were any departures, where there were any points that were not consistent with the practice of Ashkenazim, so Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramo, wrote his notes, which are called Haga'os. He's called the Hagah, the notes that he added to the Shulchan Aruch. And as a result of that choice, it was then sealed that the Shulchan Aruch, together with the notes of the Ramo, became the classic and definitive work of Jewish law for Jews all over the world in every single community that we may find ourselves, both from the 16th century right the way to the 21st century. That is the case. And still today, the Shulchan Aruch is the final word in Jewish law and Jewish communities all over the world. That was very important, significant, and it was an important outcome that came from the events of the time, and that really monumental contribution of Rav Yosef Karo of the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. So as we mentioned, the ideas of Kabbalah were now being introduced on a more popular way as a result of the school of Kabbalists in Sfat and the Arizal teachings. And with that, and with suffering within the Jewish world, so messianic longings also grow within the Jewish people. With messianic longings, we unfortunately also have false messiahs. And at that time, about 100 years after the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, an individual emerges on the scene by the name of Shabbatai Tzvi. Shabbatai Tzvi, a very important period within the Jewish world. He was born in 1626 in Turkey. And Shabbatai Tzvi was a very unique person. Obviously, he was a great Torah scholar. Obviously, he was a very brilliant person. He knew the Talmud. He knew the entire Talmud. He knew the entire Torah. And unfortunately, Shabbatai Tzvi today would be diagnosed as a manic depressant. So when he was in his manic phases, he was just untouchable. I'm sure we all have come across people that are manic, and they feel that they're going to conquer the whole world, and they don't stop, and they don't sleep, and they just, keep going. And so when a great genius has that kind of energy and focus, so it attracts attention. And that was the case of Shabbat Tzatzvi. He had received smicha at 18, and he was vouched for by many great rabbis of the time for his piety, for his knowledge. And when he was in these manic phases, he would stay up for 3 or 4 days in a row. He wouldn't sleep. He wrote hundreds of pages at a time of tshuvas and of commentaries. And he was seen as an incredible human being. And then he would get depressed. And when he was depressed, he would go into seclusion for weeks. But in the Middle Ages, seclusion was a sign of piety. No one said that he was depressed. People said that he's meditating, that he's having holy visions, that that he's growing and getting on higher spiritual levels. And then he would come back in these manic states and do all sorts of interesting things. So that was Shabbatai Tzvi. He was a very powerful person, and obviously with this kind of behavior attracted a lot of attention. And the rabbis started becoming suspicious of his behavior. And he started saying things like he had visions, he had seances, and the rabbis were uncomfortable with him and sensed that there was a problem over here. They threw him out of Turkey as a result. He went to Egypt. Now, as I mentioned, there have been many false messiahs within the history of the Jewish people, and most of them just fizzle out and nothing much becomes of them. But the difference with Shabbatai Tzvi was he came across an individual by the name of Nathan of Gaza. And Nathan of Gaza became the public relations chief of Shabbatai Tzvi. And Nathan of Gaza said that Shabbatai Tzvi was the Mashiach. He sold him as the Mashiach to the Jewish world. And Shabbatai Tzvi actually began to believe his own propaganda and believed he was Mashiach also. And so he moved to Yerushalayim and he announced that he was the one who would redeem the Jewish people. Many people believed him. In fact, about a third of the Jewish world believed that Shabbatai Tzvi was the Mashiach. And amongst them were many great rabbis and many great people. The Dutch East India Company that we know well about here in South Africa, because that's what brought the first white settlers to South Africa. The Dutch East India Company was owned by Jews, incidentally. And they write that for some time there were no ships available to them. What they were bringing spices and other interesting materials from the East, or the East Indies, the West Indies. But they said that in the 1650s there was a shortage of ships because the Jews were hiring all the ships to go to Israel. Jews throughout Europe sold their homes and their businesses, and with all the And many, many believe that this was it. This was the ultimate redemption. The problem with all the publicity is that the Sultan of Turkey also heard about it. And since he was the one who controlled the land of Israel, Israel was under the control of the Ottoman Empire, and he wasn't about to give away Israel to the Jews. And so he arrested Shabbatai Tzvi, this individual who says he's going to redeem the Jewish people, and he imprisoned him in Turkey. And he was under house arrest. He lived in a palace, and Nathan then stoked the flames even more and said, this is the test. This is the true test. What do you think? It's all going to be a smooth journey to the redemption. You're going to be tested, and this is all part of the great test. And many Jews visited Shabbatai Tzvi in Turkey. They brought him gifts. And they, you know, it actually was a great industry for the Sultan. It attracted many tourists. But then Shabbatai Tzvi began to tamper with halacha. He had young girls that took care of him. He cancelled Tisha B'Av. He said it was permissible to eat non-kosher food. He made the brocha. Instead of matir asurim, we make in the morning that God releases us from the bounds of sleep, he made the brocha matir isurim, that prohibitions are now allowed. And then the rabbonim withdrew their support from him. And eventually the Sultan also got tired and had him arrested again in Turkey. And well, he was anyway under house arrest. The Sultan said that unless Shabbatai Tzvi converts to Islam, he would be executed. The Sultan got tired of the whole game. And at the age of 40, in the year 1666, Shabbatai Tzvi converted to Islam. He had a job in the court of the Sultan. So again, Nathan says, you know, this is also part of the test and the real believers will hang on. Really frightening how things can be distorted. But one could imagine the tremendous horror and shock and turmoil in the Jewish world as a result of this whole debacle of Shabbatai Tzvi. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
As a result of Shabbatai Tzvi showing that he was not real and he was a phony, he was a charlatan, he converted to Islam in the year 1666. So there was a huge backlash in the Jewish world against his followers. There was a witch hunt that went on against anybody who had supported him. It was a very difficult time for the Jewish people. Even great Rabbonim lost their positions as a result. It was a time of great turmoil. And so as a result of that, it's pretty much part of the Jewish psyche. When people talk too quickly and too freely about Kabbalistic ideas and they don't have a strong grounding in Torah learning, when people talk too quickly and freely about Messianic ideas, so there's always a big suspicion against them because of how much suffering came about from Shabbatai Tzvi. And therefore, there's no question that when Mashiach does come, which should be speedily in our days, he's definitely going to have his work cut out for him, that is convincing the Jewish people that he is the Redeemer, because the Jewish people are now very skeptical about such things. But in Mirtz Hashem, the redemption should be soon, and there's no question Mashiach will convince us quite easily that he's the real deal. There's one more event that I want to mention, which was very significant to European Jewry, and this now is to East European Jewry, and that is in the year 1648, there was a terrible set of pogroms that took place in Eastern Europe. And up until then, as I mentioned, the Jews were invited, the Jews were protected, the Jews thrived for about 300 years. And then things began to go bad from the year 1648. And right up until the ultimate destruction of European Jewry with the Shoah in the 75 years ago. But the pleasant and comfortable stay already had started coming to an end with these terrible problems in 1648. What happened in 1648 is that there was a Ukrainian peasant who led a rebellion against the noblemen and against the Polish land laws. His name was Bogdan Chmielnicki. And Chmielnicki, in the year 1648, led a revolution rebellion, and as a result, there were massive pogroms throughout Eastern Europe. Why were there such massive pogroms? By the way, interesting enough, this was the year 1648. As we mentioned, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Midrash tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hiktim refuah lemakah, that Hashem brings about the cure before the disease. So we see with the Spanish Inquisition in 1492, it's the same time that Columbus goes out and he discovers America. So just as life in Europe for the Jews is turning bad and ending, so a new place is discovered in America. And interestingly enough, the same thing happens in 1648, where the Jews of Eastern Europe now begin to face great hardships and pogroms and suffering. When did Jan van Riebeck arrive in South Africa? 1652. So at the same time, 4 years later, that's when the place of South Africa was inhabited by European settlers, and that led to Jews coming to South Africa as well, much later, 200 years later, at the end of the 19th century. But nonetheless, we see a similar thing, that hiktim refuah lemakah, that when the Jews in Eastern Europe were suffering, so there was a new place for them to be, which would be successful and safe and prosperous for the Jews, that was beginning to emerge at the same time as well. The reason why the Jews were attacked by Chmielnicki and his hordes so viciously is because in Poland, the Jews were involved in three primary occupations. Either they were money lenders, and if you're a money lender, you're also a money collector. And that's never popular, to be a money collector. The interest in the Middle Ages was 30 or 40%. People started lending, borrowing, they would never get out of debt. And so the Jews were not seen favorably because they were the ones who were the lenders and collectors. Secondly, the Jews were involved in the liquor business. And we know there's a very high rate of alcoholism in Eastern Europe. And the Jews, there always would come a time where a non-Jewish neighbor would want some alcohol and wouldn't have money to buy, and the Jew wouldn't sell it to him. So again, they were viewed in a negative light. And thirdly, the Jews were the agents who managed the estates of the Polish landlords. And there were landlords that had the serfs that would work on their land. The Jews were the middlemen between the peasants, the serfs, and the noblemen. All three professions brought great enmity from the Polish peasants. And on top of that, there was a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism coming from the church. So when these revolts took place, when the revolution broke out, there were terrible pogroms in all the Jewish areas in Eastern Europe. 250,000 Jews were killed, which is a massive number. There were only 5 million Jews at that time in the region. So it's over 5% of the Jewish population was wiped out by these pogroms. Whole Jewish communities had to get up and run. They became, hundreds of thousands of Jews became refugees. The old established institutions were lost and were never recovered. And that really was the beginning of the end of Jews in Eastern Europe. So that, our time unfortunately has run out. So we've now discussed very fascinating movements of Ashkenazi Sephardi Jewry all over the Mediterranean basin, Ashkenazi Jewry further east, and now a further suffering for the Jews in Eastern Europe, which would be the beginning of a downhill trend and further suffering for the Jews in Eastern Europe. Next week, please God, we'll be talking about the Renaissance and the developments in the world in general and the Jewish world from the 17th century onwards. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.